Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Katrine, and today we have with us Jason Merrill, who is kind enough to share his story with us. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Katrine.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate you waiting, especially since you wrote last year, and it's taken this long to record you, so I appreciate your patience.
No problem. Worth the wait.
Now, Jason, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Utah. I was born in Salt Lake City LDS Hospital. Both parents, Pioneer Heritage, going back, you know, way back to the times of the saints in New York and Vermont. My father descended from polygamists in Idaho, polygamists there who had 12 wives. So usually I find any Merrills that are from that area in Idaho and Utah are descended from that same polygamist. So it's where I grew up and spent my grade school and high school years in Orem, Utah is where I spent most of my time.
Great. Do you consider your family to be strong, faithful LDS as you were growing up then?
Yeah, both my parents were strong LDS members. My father was had all variety of church callings, was high councilman and so on. They were both social workers. I remember people were surprised as a young child that both my parents had master's degrees. A lot of my friends growing up in Orem, it was usually the father that had an advanced degree of some sort, and most of my friends' mothers stayed at home. But both my parents had master's degrees and worked out of the home. My father worked for LDS Social Services and was for a year. We spent a year in Canada as he worked up there on the Indian reservations, doing social work up there for the church. And then we moved back to Utah, back to Utah County.
And how did you feel about your mom working? Was it fine because she didn't know better, or what was your feeling about it?
Yeah, I mean, there were times where she worked and times where she didn't out of the home, and I always liked it when she was home. But I was also, you know, very proud of my parents. They're both very smart people, and you know, proud of the fact that both my parents were educated, and it gave me a kind of a determination to be like them and go on to get my advanced degree and be like mom and dad. So it was a good home, I had oldest of five kids, typical Mormon, big family, growing up in Utah type of experience.
You went into young men's. How was that for you?
Yeah, I remember I wanted to mention, because it kind of relates to my story later on that we may get to, growing up in grade school, I didn't know any African-Americans, being in Utah County and in Orem growing up. And I remember one time in grade school, we had an African-American man that came and spoke to us, to our class in the library. And I remember just being fascinated by him. Like, here I was, this little Utah Mormon boy that had never seen an African-American man, and he was speaking to us. But I noticed something about his hands that is, you know, to me, the insides of his palms were white. And I became very skeptical of this person. I turned to my friend and I said, "Hey, he's not really black. Look at his hands," you know. And I laugh about that now, but I'm kind of ashamed of that story. But you know, growing up in Utah, I didn't know anybody like that. And it's just my whole world was I also didn't know anybody who wasn't LDS. I remember the first time I met someone that was not LDS, that it was, you know, someone of my age in high school. This boy told everyone he wasn't Mormon. And I was just, you know, really interested in him and tried to, you know, talk to him about his faith. And he said he was Catholic and this and that. And I was just really interested to learn about that. And then later on, I found out he was doing it as a joke. He was actually Mormon. So I was disappointed that I didn't know anybody that wasn't LDS growing up. I know a lot of people that weren't active, but I didn't know anybody that actually wasn't a baptized Mormon.
So even young kids knew it would be shocking to meet somebody of a different faith.
Right. A different race, a different faith. It was just a very tight little bubble I lived in. Yeah, growing up. But I do remember you asking about young men's growing up. I was involved in scouting like most young Mormon boys were, on the path to get my Eagle Scout. And it's very, you know, tied into the church that you have this path as a young man. You get the Aaronic priesthood. You become a deacon, a teacher, and a priest, and you get your Eagle Scout. And my parents were, pretty cool about everything. They didn't force us to go into scouting, and they didn't force us to get our different merit badges and things. They encouraged it, but they weren't real high. It wasn't a high pressure situation, but I do remember from a young age having a problem in some sense with authority. And I think that that plays into some factor about why and how I left the church. But I had a home teacher assigned to us, when I think I was 14 or 15, and he put a lot of pressure on me to get my Eagle Scout. My dad wasn't putting much pressure at all on me. But this man was my home teacher. And I remember he'd come over to our house, and give my family a lesson, but the lesson was very brief. And the rest of the time he'd spent with my family there in the living room talking to me about, you know, when are you going to finish your life scout? And let's plan out your service project and all this high pressure. And I maybe remember being very bothered by this. So much that I decided I was not going to get my Eagle Scout award out of spite, just because that's of the way he was. And I didn't. I got my Life Scout, and I was just a few merit badges away from Eagle Scout and a service project, and that's all I would have to do to finish it. And I decided I was not going to do it just because he had pressured me so much to do it. So I didn't. I'm not an Eagle Scout. I was a Life Scout.
Okay. So close, but not quite.
Not quite.
Did you think that it was just this man being pushy, or did you feel like there was something more religious to it, that you should be following religious orders?
You know, I don't know. I think I was kind of annoyed. I thought that that he was kind of mixing the church with the scouting program in a sense, and I'd always been a little bit bothered by that. When I grew up, the scouting program was tied in so strongly to the church that being a good scout was analogous to being a good deacon or a good teacher or a good priest. And it didn't seem like it needed to be that way. And so I think when he was tying in his calling as a home teacher to also have me get my Eagle Scout and have that be a badge of honor in his part or whatever it was, I don't know. But I think that just bothered me. And I never was a person that liked someone who thought they had authority over me, trying to take over and control my life. So I think that started some form of rebellion, I guess, in that sense.
Right. I just went to the Church History Museum a couple days ago, and a large part of the museum is dedicated to scouts, to scouting. Mm-hmm. And I was just surprised, like, really? That's our church history, is the scouting program?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great program. I still think it's a good program for young men to participate in. I think I always thought it was odd that the young women's program was so vastly different, though, from the young men's program, the scouting program. You know, I don't think they unfortunately had quite the same experience that the scouts got growing up. I never was quite sure why that was, but.
And then you're growing up, getting towards missionary age, and I imagine there's pressure on you since you're the oldest of five to go on a mission.
Yeah, oldest of five. My father did not serve a mission. He was drafted to go into the army during the Korean War. And so during his years, and back then it wasn't as common for every young man to serve a mission. So he didn't serve a mission, but he was in the army, and he always, you know, really was looking forward to the day I'd serve a mission, and be his missionary. I had spent a lot of time with my father growing up. He and I are very close, and he's what you'd call a bibliophile. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's a bibliophile is someone who has a strong love of books or collecting books. Mm-hmm. And we shared this love together. I've always been very interested in science, particularly astronomy, geography, and so on. I'd spend hours reading books on space and staring at maps and learning about this great big universe, this big world that existed outside of Utah County. And I remember lying on my bed with my father and just talking about the Book of Abraham, because that's the, you know, I was surprised to learn from my father there's this whole other set of scripture that I didn't hear about in primary that talks about the planet that God lives on and the method that starlight comes from God's world to our sun and the times and the seasons, the way God measures times. I was completely fascinated as a kid talking to my father about this, and he seemed to be so knowledgeable. My father's he's obsessed with Hugh Nibley books and very deep doctrine type writings. And he's just a very smart man, a very intellectual man that knows a lot about the church and its history and doctrine and has a shared fascination with science. So we had that commonality growing up. You know, it's something I always cherished as a young boy. And I thought, wow, my father knows so much. Here's this man that that has a shared interest with me, and he can teach me about these things, and I can go on and be a missionary and teach this to the world, and you know, these people out here that don't have the same knowledge that we as Mormons have about the way the universe works and the way God measures times, that you just can't find the same sort of references in the Bible. So I'm excited to go on my mission and make him proud, I guess.
Wow. Did you realize at the time that that wasn't common knowledge, that most church people don't discuss that kind of information?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I was always, you know, sitting in church thinking about this stuff instead of, you know, I'd get so bored sitting there listening to the same types of lessons over and over again. So I'd flip up my scriptures and read the book of Abraham and stare at the papyrus and read about these translations that Joseph Smith had done about where God comes from and the planet he lives on. And I was always hoping they'd bring it up in Sunday school or primary or young men's. We'd talk about this stuff, and it rarely came up. It was all about other things. But yeah, so I'd spend a lot of time talking with my father about it. And then I'd also go off and spend more time reading in books and learning about the universe and going to science camp and things like that.
Okay. And did you want to go on a mission?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as young men are trained in the church to do, everyone serves a mission. It's kind of very much, you know, looked down upon if you don't serve. I thought, gosh, if I don't go on a mission and I try to go somewhere like BYU or some school, I'm not going to be able to find a nice young Mormon girl to marry. They're not going to take a second look at me. So that was shamefully so part of the motivation, I think, to serve a mission is that you had to in order to find a good other Mormon girl to marry and carry out your life plan as the church prescribes it. So, but I also had a testimony, had a strong desire to share the gospel and have this great missionary experience that other missionaries I'd heard about in their farewell homecoming or their homecoming speeches. And as I mentioned before, I've always been fascinated with the world and with geography and maps. And I wanted to go out in there and see the world and experience it and get outside of this Utah bubble that I lived in for so long. So I spent a year after high school. I went to BYU, Idaho, which is called Rick's College back then. I got my mission call to Peru to serve in Lima, Peru. So I was excited about that. And my family had the usual farewell and off I went.
Very cool. What year did you go on your mission?
It was 1990. Let's see. I left in 1990. So a year after high school. I'm 43, so yeah. I went into the MTC, and I remember I didn't like it from the very beginning. As soon as I got there to the MTC, it was just a very different experience than what I was expecting. I don't know what I was expecting, but I think a lot of it had to do with almost immediately after I left, I felt like there was something wrong at home. My parents had been acting strangely. They'd been having a hard time getting along, and I just felt like they were going through a divorce. They'd write me separate letters, and I remember sitting in my room in the MTC just thinking, gosh, my family's breaking up. My parents are getting divorced. They live 20 minutes away, and I can't see them, or I can only write them a letter once a week. And it just threw me into this very high state of anxiety, being there and feeling helpless and trapped. I got very ill, very sick. I was having back spasms and severe back pain, and went to the doctor in the MTC, and they couldn't quite figure out what was going on, but it just heightened my whole depression and anxiety that just kept growing every day I was in there. I remember I had also had a mission companion, my first mission companion assigned to me in the MTC. He and I, we didn't get along so well, and it might have been part of just he was trying to cope with a companion that had this difficult time, but we had a difficult time getting along, and I remember he was very he was a stickler about the rules. So, you know, in the MTC, you have even stronger or harsher rules almost than you have out in the mission field, or stricter rules, I should say. He would kind of nag me about this, and if I'd made a little mistake or whatever, he'd gently remind me, and it went back to this whole authority thing where I just kept thinking, well, who are you? You know, I know you're my companion, but I had this growing resentment for him, I think. And I remember one incident in particular. It was the 4th of July, and missionaries were supposed to be in bed at a certain time. I don't remember what it was, 9:30 or 10 or something like that. And that year, the fireworks were delayed for some reason. And we'd all, the four of us, that were in this room. You know, they have a room with four missionaries and two bunk beds. And I was lying there in my top bunk, and I heard, you know, this loud boom and lights flashing from outside, and they were setting off the fireworks at the BYU Stadium of Fire. And the other three missionaries in the room, including my companion, jumped out of bed and ran over to the window and said, "Oh, look, you know, the fireworks are going off, and get up out of bed, Elder Merrill." And I was already pretty upset at my companion. For some reason, I felt like, well, I'm going to be super obedient. I'm going to, and just out of spite almost, I'm going to lie here in bed and not get up and look at the fireworks. And they, I remember that was just a very low moment for me, just feeling, what have I gotten myself into? You know, this is crazy. Yeah, I had a hard time in the MTC.
So you taught him a lesson, didn't you?
I just thought, this guy's being a jerk. And
yeah.
So yeah.
It seems like people that are sticklers to the rule, for at least from when I've talked to people, those that are sticklers to the rule are doing it because they feel so much pressure to be righteous and to do everything right. And it's hard for everyone.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Did the MTC improve at all while you were there for you?
Well, what happened was this went on for several weeks, and I was preparing to learn Spanish and go down to Peru. And I heard horror stories from other missionaries in the MTC about, oh, I had a brother that served in Peru, and he had to fight malaria, and he had to take showers at the bucket, and it was horrible. And I just heard all these stories that were not helping. And I just remember being very, very anxious, being sick all the time, and I was constantly having to run to the bathroom, and it was just a miserable time. And after about 3 weeks of this, they decided that it would be best if I, actually what they did was they, before I even went home, the branch president who was assigned to us decided to take me and my companion and two other missionaries down to, out of the MTC completely, which I'm sure they had to get special permission to do. And they took us down to his home in Spanish Fork, and his wife served us breakfast one morning. And I think they were just trying to get me out of that situation for a bit and get me out of the stress I was experiencing and the worry I had about my family getting divorced, and just get me out of the situation. It was a really kind thing. I remember that. And I remember they tried to do it in a way where it seemed like, oh, we just wanted to get some missionaries out. They didn't directly say it was because of me, but they did that. And then, you know, it didn't quite help. I still fell back into this depression and anxiety and this feeling physically ill all the time. And my mission companion one day said, let's go for a walk. And we were walking outside, him and two other missionaries. We were walking outside the MTC, right outside on the front doors of the MTC Missionary Training Center in Provo. And I had a strange feeling to turn around. I turned around and my father was standing there. And I ran up to him and gave him a big hug. And he said, let's go home, son. And he took me home. And
really?
So it was just, yeah. Yeah, they'd arranged this kind of meeting for me to meet my father and take me home this way. And let me just take a break from the MTC, get feeling better, talk to my family about the situation going on there, and then if I was feeling up for it, send me back out and reassign me to go serve a mission. So I went home.
Sorry, you had no idea that they were thinking of sending you home?
No, I had no idea. I'd been talking to a counselor in the MTC about it and seeing a doctor about my back pain, and there was no talk beforehand that they were going to sort of do this kind ambush and have my father pick me up. But it was a neat thing. You know, I was very relieved. I can't, that was one of the worst times of my life. And there my father was to rescue me. So I went home for a week, I think it was, or maybe a week and a half. And it was just me and my dad. My mom had taken my brothers and sisters to California for a vacation, which I also thought was odd, being that Harry was home, my parents weren't vacationing together. But I spent a week at home with my dad. I remember I was so exhausted. I slept for days. I was worn out. I was physically sick, and I was just lying there healing. And my dad took care of me, and it was a good experience. I remember though being very embarrassed and having to hide low because I didn't want my neighbors to know that I'd come home from my missions after being gone for 3 weeks in the training center. And you know, I knew there was probably a lot of speculation and gossip. So I just kind of laid low. And then eventually my stake president came over one day and said, because I'd indicated I wanted to go back and serve my mission. I was, you know, determined to push, to get feeling better. And once I was physically feeling better and emotionally, that I'd be ready to go back. And so one night the stake president came over and visited me in my house and said, we'd like to extend a calling to you to serve as a missionary in the Idaho Boise mission. And I remember immediately being very disappointed, I guess, being a Utah boy and then being called to serve in Idaho.
Especially since you were just at school there, right?
Right. And I just spent a year there at BYU Idaho. So, but then I, you know, immediately thought, well, I was out there to teach the gospel. I was not going out there to have a vacation. The people in Idaho need the gospel as much as the people in Peru and elsewhere. So I just changed my attitude about it. I went back in the MTC for a few weeks and had a fantastic experience. I just had a different attitude about it. I was determined to make my mission a success, and I was just very excited and thrilled. And so I actually flew me on a plane up to Idaho, to Boise, and I served my mission up there and met a lot of great people I'm still really good friends with to this day. And I had a lot of good experiences. Although I learned some Spanish, so they assigned me to be in a Spanish speaking companionship for the first part of my mission. I remember when I would tell my story, my mission, and some of the spiritual experiences I had, the first one that I often tell is that I had this. The first person we baptized was a man that didn't speak any English. He was a migrant worker. I taught him the lesson in Spanish in my you know, very poor Spanish from being in the missionary training center for just a short amount of time. But I remember when I baptized him, I was very nervous. It's my first time baptizing anybody. And this 19-year-old kid from Utah and this man from Mexico, I was trying to explain to him before the baptism how I was going to lay him down in the water. And I was trying to do this in very broken Spanish. And we were practicing out in the foyer. And we got into the font. And I said the baptismal prayer in Spanish perfectly. And as I lowered him down into the water, I hit his head on the stairs really, really hard. I could see him squinting under the water like he was in pain. But I just, you know, I kept going and I baptized him, and I could see he was rubbing his head when I pulled him out of the water. But I you know, we were getting dressed in the dressing room after the baptism. He said to me, Elder Merrill, that was the most beautiful experience of my life. At least what I can make out in Spanish. Him saying this to me could have been saying, thanks a lot for hit my head on the stairs, you jerk. But yeah, so I always cited that story and that experience as just a very powerful experience that I first had out in the mission field.
Nice. Anything else on your mission you want to talk about?
Two things, I guess. One was I was very determined to gain a testimony. I don't feel like I had a real strong testimony going into my mission. I felt like, yeah, I think it's true. I've been told it's true. I do the things I'm supposed to. I go to church. You know, I do the things I'm, again, Mormon boys supposed to do. But I didn't ever feel like I had a burning, strong witness of the Spirit. So this goes back to the MTC. When I first got there, I thought, you know, I need to read the Book of Mormon. I've read lots of parts of it, but I never read it back cover to cover. So I was determined to start doing that. And I started reading and said a prayer before I started. And the first chapter or two, it talks about Lehi building an altar. And suddenly I just felt like, wow, this is a very righteous man. I felt like this was the spiritual experience I've been looking for. True. This righteous man, this story of him going out and building an altar. And so I kind of hung on that as my testimony for a long time. It kind of seems a little bit quaint now or silly, but at the time it was what I kind of based my testimony on, is just feeling like, you know, this was a testimony to me this church was true. So I based a lot of it going to the mission field on that. I helped baptize 23 people, I think. But working in Idaho,
that's got to be really good in Idaho.
Yeah, back then I think it was about on par average, but the reason it was so high is because I quickly realized that a lot of the people we were baptizing were young children. These were children of less actives who just wanted their children to be baptized. They felt like it was an important ordinance to have, you know, if they weren't going to be attending church. So a lot of these were just kids 9, 10, 11 years old that we were baptizing. I think I only baptized three adults in my 2 years. And of those three adults, two of them I didn't think would stick with the church. I don't know that they have or not. And one was a young woman that I felt was one of those golden investigators, my only golden, you know, investigator that I, my whole mission, when she joined the church, I was very thrilled. And then, I found out a few years later that she left the church and is no longer with the church. So overall, it was a good experience. I don't know that I hopefully helped, you know, at the time I felt like I wish I'd helped some people, but, I don't know that I did so much, but it was a very definitely a good growing experience for me. I remember being, shocked when I got out there of how different missionaries were than what I had pictured in my mind. You know, you picture every missionary gets up at 6:30 in the morning and they read their scriptures together and they eat their oatmeal and they get on their bikes and they go out there and they tract all day long and they have these spiritual experiences and, you know, a tear or two is shed and they come home and say their prayers and go to bed. And that's what I picture missionary life to be like. And I came out there and I just had a series of experiences, I think, that just told me that wasn't the way it was, at least in where I was serving at the time. I remember my first missionary preparation day. We went to an elder's apartment in Pocatello, and they had an apartment on top of an old grocery store that was no longer a grocery store, just empty on the bottom. And it was a big party. They had movies playing. They had a barbecue going on the grill, on the top of the roof. They were playing with snakes they'd captured somewhere in a field. They'd set up the grocery store, the whole floor had been emptied out, and everybody had their mission bikes, polo on their bikes with a soccer ball and baseball bats, and it was just a big party, and I was really shocked and surprised at how different it was. I remember there was missionaries that got jobs. There were some missionaries that got a job doing sighting for someone. They're making money on the side. They'd go out and do sighting during the day, and then they do some missionary lessons at night and come home and collect a nice paycheck.
Wow.
There was,
did there was, the president know about this?
I don't think he did. I mean, I'm sure he didn't know about some of these things. There was some missionaries that unfortunately, and this made me really sad, but they, there was one elder that had some mental disabilities, and they tied him up as a joke and were making fun of him and things, and some things that I just saw some surprising behavior that was more indicative, seemed like more of a fraternity type environment than what I pictured is spiritual, you know, missionary type experience. In fact, one missionary got married on his mission. And I always thought, well, that's one of those stories, but I had heard this from his companion. Apparently the story is he was working in an area in Idaho and was teaching a family, and there was a young woman that he'd fallen in love with, that he'd been working with and teaching, and but he kept it very quiet, and as you're supposed to keep your heart locked and not do any dating or flirting when you're a missionary.
Or any marrying.
any marrying, right. So one day his companion, he said to his companion, hey, I'm going to split off with you for the day. Let's meet up. I'm going to, because, you know, on P-Days, you can split off with a different missionary. At least you could back then. You could go off with somebody who wasn't your mission companion. So he arranged to be away from his companion during that day and meet up at the courthouse later. And so his companion thought, well, that's odd, you know. So he went off and played racquetball or played basketball and met up with him later at the courthouse. And when he showed up, there was his mission companion dressed in his suit. And this girl was there with her entire family. And he walked up to him and said, I'd like you to be my best man at my wedding. He said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm getting married. And it was this young woman that he decided he was in love with enough to get married. And he married him right on the spot. The judge married him right there. And then they apparently called up the mission president and said that you need to send me home now. I've just gotten married. And so this was the mission president's first day as the new mission president in the new mission in Idaho and in the new Pocatello mission. So that was a rude awakening for him.
Way to get sent home.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah, there was a lot of crazy things like that that went on my mission. The story was, and I don't know if this is true, but they back then, they would, if a missionary was having trouble in some way, in a spiritual way, or obeying the rules to an extreme extent, instead of them sending them home, a lot of times they would transfer them to another mission locally in hopes a different environment would help. So we had, it seemed for whatever reason, we got a lot of missionaries from Utah and other missions in the surrounding area were sent to our mission to be reformed. So there was a culture there for a while that was very different, I guess, as far as the rules go, the mission rules.
All right. So you didn't marry anyone while you're on your mission.
I did not.
And then you completed the full 2 years.
I did. I served my full 2 years, had a great time, came back, did the typical, you know, dating thing, finished out my time at BYU-Idaho. My family went through some hard times. I need to back up a little bit. My parents ended up getting divorced after all. It was about 6 months before I was set to come home. My mom called me up one day in tears and said that she's divorcing my father, and that was tough to not be home during that time, be out there as a missionary and know that your worst fears are confirmed and your family is splitting up. But so I came home to a very different family than the one I left, you know, so that was difficult, but I adjusted. I went back to school and finished my associates, and then my parents, through the divorce, they had a lot of financial troubles, and then both my parents lost both of their jobs at the same time. And so we went on church welfare, for about a full year. I took a year off school to be at home with my mom and help provide for the family and things. And so that was a tough time, but, I was grateful for the church, for the support that gave us back then.
So by this time you're what, 23, 24 years old?
Yeah, 24 at this point. And then, since my job, I was a full-time substitute at a junior high school, I decided I wanted to be a school teacher, so I went back to Utah State to finish up my bachelor's degree, and then decided I wanted to get a master's degree in instructional technology, so I went back and did that, and then, you know, met someone, end of my master's degree program, got married in the Logan Temple, and then just lived out the basic Mormon life as a young married couple. We moved from Logan to Seattle, and then Seattle to Virginia, and then down to Charlotte, North Carolina. So,
and were those moves for your work?
Yeah, just various jobs. Yeah, worked for different companies. So.
Okay. All right. And I'm sorry, where was the last place you said? Virginia?
Virginia, and then I ended up in Charlotte, North Carolina, is where I'm currently located.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
And being the good Mormon couple, you had to start having children right away, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much pressure. And we're my wife at the time, I'm no longer married to, but we would always get highly annoyed at church when people would constantly ask us, when are you having children and when are you having kids? And they meant it in a nice, kind way, but it was very annoying. And we couldn't have children. And you know, we eventually, after 8 years, we decided to adopt. So we adopted a young African-American girl as a newborn here in Charlotte, and we're just thrilled and happy as could be to have her in our lives. But that, I think, opened my eyes a little more about thinking about the church and its past dealings with people of different races, particularly African-Americans, and denying them both the priesthood and the ability to go and be in the temple. And I think it made me start to think more and more about it, and having this conflict in my mind of how could God deny someone those blessings based on their skin color when he had created them in the first place. It didn't make any sense to me. And I thought long and hard about it, and I thought, well, but what if I had been living back in the 1960s, and instead of adopting a young girl, we had adopted a young boy, and we also hypothetically had a boy the same age who was white. How could I tell my adopted African-American son when he turns 12 that he could not get the priesthood because of his skin color? Or how could I tell if it was a girl, how could I tell her that she couldn't get married in the temple like her brother or her sisters? And how could I go to their weddings, my sons or daughters, knowing that one of my children couldn't be there because of their skin color, and I just couldn't. And I'd spent a lot of time talking to my bishop about it and stake presidents. It just bothered me more and more, and no one seemed to have a good answer. The one that started to make the most sense to me was they said, well, prophets are not perfect and they make mistakes. And that worked for a little while until I started to think more about that. And I thought, well, wait a minute. What does modern revelation mean? What does it mean to be a prophet? What does it mean to be an apostle and receive direct revelation from God? You know, I'd grown up thinking these men have seen Christ as what I had believed, or they had at least had a strong connection, a different sort of revelation or prayer that was much different than what we experience as normal members of the church, where they could get direct guidance from the Lord on how to run the church and what kind of policies to enact. And David L. McKay had gone to the temple and prayed about this issue of African Americans and the priesthood in the temple, and been told that it's not time yet, and it's not time for them to have the blessings of the priesthood. I couldn't understand why God would be, in a sense, racist, that he would create people and give them certain attributes of certain skin type, color, or physical attributes. They would be considered a certain race, and therefore we'd be denied these blessings and have to endure their lives as something somewhat lesser citizens of the church. It just didn't make a lot of sense, and it started to really get me thinking more and more about the truthfulness of the church.
And were you aware of the troubles in history of the church concerning race before you had your daughter, or did this all come up after?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I definitely was. I'd always known about, you know, the 1978 revelation, and the church had a long history of African Americans not being allowed to have those blessings, and I had always done what most members of the church, I think, had done, and said, well, we don't understand why God does what he does, but there's a reason for it, and it just wasn't their time. They weren't ready for it.
And it becomes personal when it's your daughter.
But yeah, it became very personal when it was my daughter. I remember we had a relative over one time who was an older gentleman and grown up in the South, and he'd mentioned something highly negative about African Americans. My daughter wasn't in the room at the time, but I remember getting very, very, very defensive and very upset and asked him to leave. And that was a moment for me that thought, wow, I think I have changed, in a sense, my attitude about race, where I didn't realize that I don't think I was ever racist growing up, but I just didn't have that connection, if that makes sense, to what racism means, or what it means to be offended if someone says something or does something based on the way someone looks, you know, or what race they come from, or cultural background. So,
absolutely. And you said you talked about that with some church leaders. Was there anything else that caused problems for you?
Yeah, well, even before that, I think it goes back about 8 years, 9 years ago, when one of my sisters had diabetes since she was a child and always struggled with health issues. And she didn't really stick to the prescribed way to live her life as far as the church goes. She got pregnant when she was, I think, about 20 years old, and against the advisement of her doctors, decided to go ahead and have the baby, not get an abortion. But that pregnancy ruined her kidneys. The baby came out premature, but thrived and is fine today. But my sister went on this downward health spiral from there with kidney failure, and she died several years back. And I remember at the time, I think that's where I can pinpoint my first real faith crisis, thinking about her and where she was now, if she still existed. And I, going back to my interest in astronomy and physics and the universe and science, at the same time I've been reading this book called Our Living Multiverse. It's a great book by Fred Adams. It's called, the subtitle is A Book of Genesis in 0 to 7 chapters. And he basically lays out, without any sort of bias, it seemed to me, reading the book, of how the universe began, starting with the Big Bang theory, going through the formation of heavier and heavier atoms, and the way gravity started to create pull galaxies together, and the way entropy increased, and the way planets were formed, and you know, life and so on. And reading this book, it just opened my eyes. I'd never really thought about it much, about how I always thought, you know, well, the universe is so complex and so vast and so there's so much to it that there's no way it could have evolved naturally. It had to been God, something God did. But reading this book, it would kind of felt like I had seen how a very large house had been built from the very ground up, where if you're looking at it, you know, I always thought, looking at a large house, you might, not knowing anything about the construction process or about materials, you might be amazed about how it came together. But when you learn more about what goes into it and how they lay the foundation, how they pour the concrete and how they nail things together, I could kind of see how it all came together. And that made me start to really question, is there a God? Is a God necessary? And I started to look at the church from the outside, in a sense, thinking, was it necessary for God to be involved in the creation of the universe and the formation of life? And what would the world look like without a God there to direct it? And so I think my first thoughts about coming out of Mormonism really came from questioning God, by taking a hard look at science and what the church taught me and comparing it that way. So I tell people this, and some people don't understand it, but some people that have experienced it do, but I always say that I lost my faith in God before I lost my faith in the Restoration and Joseph Smith. And it doesn't make sense to me now, but back then it did for whatever reason. I think it had been so ingrained into me, the Book of Mormon and the Joseph Smith story and all that, that I started to doubt God first.
Okay. And was there a lot of cognitive dissonance going on there? Were you frightened, worried? Did you feel like you were going somewhere you shouldn't go?
Definitely. Yeah, a lot of that. I think classic case of cognitive dissonance being that I had doubts that there was a God or perhaps even an afterlife. Yet, you know, the Book of Mormon and the church story was still true. And I don't think that phase lasted very long, though. I had those kind of question, nagging thoughts about the start of just sitting in church and listening to what they were saying. And I was an elders quorum president. I was a ward clerk twice. I spent a lot of time in bishopric meetings and seeing how the church functions and a lot of teaching callings. I started to think more and more about the way the church really works sometimes is that a lot of time is spent on supporting the institution itself and less about teaching about Christ and how to be a better person and how to be a better father or husband or mother, and more about, you know, how do we get our home teaching numbers up, and who's going to be at the stake center on Saturday to set up chairs for priesthood meeting, and how can we, what are some ways we can be better teachers when we teach our Relief Society lessons and things like that. And I start to see it more and more from the outside as a lot of the functions of the church being to support the church itself. And I think that started nagging me for a while. But eventually, towards the end of that 8-year period, you know, having been elders quorum president and serving as primary teacher, I just said, like, I'd stopped believing. I was teaching lessons on, I remember I was teaching primary lessons about in the New Testament about Jesus. And I remember thinking, I'm teaching these kids something that I don't necessarily believe. I believe the message of Christianity, but I don't know if Christ actually existed or these other things in the manual are true. And eventually it just led to me deciding I didn't believe it anymore. And I have a close friend that I was roommates with who introduced me to my ex-wife, actually. And he came out, as gay to my ex-wife and I at the time. And he was very, emotional about it and telling us, you know, that he tried for many years to hold his faith together and decided he couldn't be Mormon anymore, and being gay is who he was. And I remember driving back from this meeting that my ex-wife and I had with him about his, when he came out to us. And I remember asking her, I said, where is there a place for my friend who's gay in the church? I don't understand how the church can really be welcoming to them if they are welcome in church but are not allowed to have, not just, they're not allowed to not just be married, but also to not have a relationship of any kind. That would include holding hands with someone or kissing someone they care about and love, having no relationship of any kind. Where's the place for them? Do they really have to endure and wait for the next life? And I just couldn't get, and she didn't know either. She didn't know the answer to that. It started to bother me more and more, and I think that really brought me to a final decision about leaving the church. And the first one was the way African Americans were treated in the church prior to 1978. The second being I could not reconcile the way the church policies about homosexuality, and the third being my conflicts between science, you know, not being able to figure out why we would teach the earth is 6,000 years old when it's clearly evident that the church is there, that the earth is billions of years old, and Noah's Ark and all these things that I just could not reconcile with science, I think. And I eventually decided that I was done.
And you had said that you used to discuss a lot of things with your dad. Did you talk to him about any of these concerns?
Yeah, I did. We spent hours on the phone, hours and hours and hours after I told him that I was not going to be a member of the church anymore. I would not be coming back. And, you know, he tried in different ways to talk me out of it and explain in his own way and of why some of these presumptions I have or thoughts I have were wrong. And the discussions were very heated at first, and then over time they got calmer and calmer and more respectful, and we still talk to this day about things, but they're just very friendly, warm discussions. My dad's a great man. He's still very active in the church and believes what he believes, and I don't try to convince him otherwise. I speak to my mother as well, and we have a good relationship. We don't talk as often about the doctrinal things, but she's hopeful that someday I'll come back to the church, and my siblings as well. So,
are you the only sibling that's left?
I have two brothers and a sister, and one of my brothers is not active in the church, but I have a brother and sister that are. So,
all right. You don't have to answer this if it's too personal, but did any of this, how did this affect your marriage?
Yeah, I mean, out of respect for her privacy and for mine, I won't go into too much detail, but it definitely affected our relationship. And she being a very strong believing Mormon and me telling her that I didn't believe in it anymore was a factor. But I also I need to figure out how to raise our daughter as well, being I know she'd be have parents of two different beliefs, and doubly compounded in complexity by the fact that I, you know, we weren't married anymore. So I've had to, you know, figure that out myself, and I've just decided I want her to grow up and make the choice herself. If she chooses to believe the Mormon story and Mormonism, then great. I will support her. I don't agree with the way the church, some of the church's policies, and I certainly don't believe in the truth claims, but I do think the church does a lot of good things, and, you know, it teaches some good morals and does some good service and things like that. So if it makes her happy, then I'm happy to support her in that. But if it doesn't, then I'll support her whatever she chooses to do. And I just, the main thing I want her to know is that she needs to choose it for herself. I always felt like it was always forced upon me that I was born into this church. I had to believe because this is how I was raised. I had to serve a mission because that's what I do as a young man. I had to marry in the temple. That's what everybody does. That's what you need to do to get to the highest degree of glory. And so it always felt like it was forced upon me, and I needed it to be a personal choice. And when it came down to it, I spent a lot of time, years and years, praying about it, about my testimony in the church. Never felt like I got a clear answer from God that it was true. Never. I was waiting for that answer, but never getting one. So if she's going to stick with it, then I want her to feel strongly about it and to do it because she wants to, not just someone's telling her to do it.
It sounds so healthy.
And, you know, and I'm happy, you know, I think some people are surprised, my friends or family that talk to me sometimes about my new life. And, you know, I'm remarried now. I've found a wonderful woman that I fell deeply in love with, and we recently got married, and she's never been Mormon. But she endures a lot of my wanting to talk about my experience in Mormonism, and she's made friends with a lot of my other friends who are either, some are Mormon and many are not. But, you know, I'm very happy in my new life, and don't regret leaving the church. There was some pain leaving the church and leaving it and wondering, well, what now? If there is no God or no afterlife, then what? And having to reconcile that and having had a whole, my whole world turned around. But, I'm very, you know, I'm very in a good place now.
Well, good. And did you look to find another religion, or do you consider yourself atheist, or what are your beliefs now?
I briefly flirted with going to some of their churches, but I quickly discovered that it wasn't much different in some sense than Mormonism. I think it was more about a loss of community than anything, but I'd consider myself an agnostic, atheist leaning agnostic. I am highly skeptical that there is a supernatural being out there looking over my life and intervening in other people's lives and not in others. That if the supernatural being is all powerful, that he wouldn't stop child cancer or children being raped in Africa and starvation and things like that. So, you know, but I, being scientifically minded, I think I've tried to maintain a level of agnosticism where I'm not entirely, I can't entirely be sure without more sure evidence, I guess. There's not a God or an afterlife. So, you know, I've studied a lot about near-death experiences as a start out of curiosity, but looking at those from a purely scientific viewpoint, looking at the science behind some of them, and found some interesting things that give me some hope. I'm still very skeptical. So I just live my life as what I'd call an atheist-leaning agnostic, and that this is probably it, and there may not be more after this, but if there is, I'll be happy. If not, then I've lived my life as I wanted to live it, and just having basic humanist type morals, I guess, is what my real goal is, to be kind to other people, to help others be happy myself, be healthy, leave this, treat the world and the environment well, and just live a good life.
Nice. I did want to ask, since you are able to carry on conversations with your believing family members, do you have any advice for people that really want to have that connection with their own family but can't seem to do that?
Yeah, I think just the more you can communicate, the better. Every family is different. Every interpersonal dynamic is different. There's always all sorts of history that goes with those dynamics. But, and my family's great. I love my siblings. My parents are fantastic, even though we don't see eye to eye on religion. They don't press the issue with me anymore, and they're great. Now, I know other friends of mine who have a much more heated relationship with their parents, whose parents or siblings are still trying to force some sort of dogma on them or way to live their life or whatever. But the thing that worked for me was just to keep that dialogue open and keep talking about it and keep communication open and keep it civil. You know, things get heated and people tend to shut down, and they may shut down for a day, a week, a month, a year, or more. And if I could, at times I could keep things civil, it kept the dialogue flowing more easily. So, you know, I had to see it from their perspective and my perspective to make it work. And I think there was times when I was very angry at the church and for dragging me through it for lost years of whatever. But, you know, I realize now I'm not angry at church members, and I'm not really angry at the church itself. Everyone's a product of the institution that they were raised up in. And I look at my family and friends that way, who are members of the church, and think, you know, if they're happy and this is what they choose to believe, I'll respect that. And I'll, you know, even encourage it if they want to stay in it. So for people out there struggling with the same sort of, with the sort of family dynamics or friendships that are become difficult when you leave the church, my only advice would be just to stick with it and try to keep that communication open and friendly and honest. And hopefully eventually they'll see that, you know, they can open up and get some of their feelings out as well. And then hopefully the relationship will improve.
Great. Great. Well, I really appreciate it. I'm not scientifically minded, so it's always interesting to hear it from a different perspective. And a lot of things just click for me as you were talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. It was fun. I enjoyed it. And I, you know, I'm active in the ex-Mormon community. I have a Facebook group that we talk about the alcohol and things that people are new to those, some of those things. And we discuss that, and I started a blog, a satirical blog about a bishop who's coping with his ward members struggling with issues of science and Mormonism. I don't know if I'll stick with it. I need to spend some more time with it, but I might take it in a different direction. But okay. I'm having fun. So, yeah.
Do you want to tell people what the blog is or no?
I'll put it in the, maybe we can put it in the show notes after.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it right now, but, yeah. It's called, the blog is called Noah's My Homeboy. So if they want to go there, it's,
okay.
It's actually the URL is Noah's My Homeboy. It's on WordPress, so.
Well, awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today.
All right.
If you, like Jason, want to be on Mormon Expression Voices, go ahead and send me an email at voices@mormonexpression.com. And everybody have a good week, and we'll be back.
Bad man.